Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My special guest this week is Dale Bridenbaugh, a former nuclear engineer and retired energy consultant to government and other groups interested in evaluation of nuclear power plant safety and licensing. Dale was employed for around 20 years with General Electric, where he undertook many different roles, including being responsible for the establishment and management of systems to monitor and measure boiling water reactor equipment and system operational performance. In his role as a consultant within his own company and others, Dale worked with many organisations in the US and overseas, including the Swedish Energy Commission, the Union of Concerned Scientists, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Dale Bridenbaugh, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you.
Now, Dale, I'll never forget when I first met you and your two other contemporaries, partners in crime, Greg Miner and Dick Hubbard. And it was in California in a house surrounded by flowers in the garden and everything. And there seemed to be a sort of general hush-hush in this conversation. I've got a bit of background. You were all sitting there really nervous, and it turned out that the three of you had decided to resign from General Electric for certain reasons as nuclear engineers. And it was a fairly profound day for me, and in fact, I think for you too. Why don't you tell the audience, Dale Bridenbaugh, why you and Greg Miner and Dick Hubbard decided at that point in time, I think it was 1976, to resign from General Electric?
Well, you're correct, Helen. It was in 1976, and the date of our three resignations was February 2nd, 1976. We had, of course, decided to do that sometime before that, and it was a result of being concerned about the way we felt the nuclear program was being managed within the United States and around the world. At the time, there was a big campaign underway in the state of California to try and pass a nuclear safeguards initiative, which would have required that certain safety studies be performed before any more nuclear plants could be built within the state.
That was Prop 15, wasn't it?
That was Prop 15, yes. And at the time, of course, my job was basically to take care of all the problems that were coming up with the nuclear plants that GE had built and that were in operation around the world. And even more so, or even more specific to that, I had been assigned about a year prior to February to head up a special reevaluation of the safety of the Mark I containments that most of GE's nuclear plants at that time were being supplied with. It happens to be the same containment system that is present at the Fukushima plant in Japan that we are all very familiar with right now. In 1976, that safety reevaluation program began in the spring of 1975, and I was assigned as the project manager to perform or to follow or organize the work that GE was doing in support of the 16 domestic utilities that had GE Mark I plants. As time went on, I became very concerned about the fact that we weren't certain that those plants would be able to survive the accident that they were supposedly designed to contain.
What sort of accident, Dale?
Well, the accident that nuclear plants are supposed to be able to survive are a major rupture of the largest pipe within the reactor primary system, and to contain any radioactive material that might be released without any leakage subsequent to that event.
Well, now, just explain to us, what's a major pipe within the... Are you talking about a huge pipe that transports water into the primary cooling system in the containment vessel? Is that the sort of thing you're talking... And that would lead to a meltdown? Is that what you're talking about, Dale?
Well, it could be one of those, yes. There are many, many pipes within the reactor system, of course.
Yeah.
And there are... The primary system is the reactor pressure vessel, which houses the reactor fuel, the fuel that generates the heat. And then there are cooling pipes that come in. There are steam pipes that go out, and there are emergency cooling systems that are attached to the reactor pressure vessel itself. What the licensing requirements state is that the system should be designed to be able to withstand a break in the largest pipe that is attached to the reactor pressure vessel.
Which would lead to what? I mean, what ramifications would that have?
Well, what ramifications that would have is that the system would be isolated. Hopefully, all the valves would close, but the cooling water for the reactor fuel and the steam that is being generated by that hot nuclear fuel would escape from the reactor pressure vessel, and it would be necessary, theoretically, what would happen is that the containment system that surrounds the reactor pressure vessel and the piping would be able to contain all of that energy, steam, and radioactive material and not let anything get out. The problem that arose in 1975 is it became knowledge that the systems that had been designed for the Mark I's and the Mark II's plants had not taken into account what is called hydrodynamic loads, which is a term for forces that could be exerted upon the containment system that could cause it to rupture and release radioactive material.
Like vibration and stuff like that?
That's correct, yeah. Like vibratory forces resulting from the rapid discharge of steam into pools of water.
Yeah.
So anyway, that is what I was doing in 1975 and 76.
And did you have confidence that in fact these Mark I containment vessels would be able to withstand such a situation, Dale?
No, we did not have confidence.
Why?
Because they hadn't been designed to withstand that.
Oh, my God. Well, why weren't they designed to withstand that if that was a sort of... The general standard and criteria for, you know, having a major accident.
It was a design error or a shortcoming or something that was overlooked.
Did someone forget?
Well, yeah, I guess it's even more important than somebody forgot. What they did do is they said that they looked at how much energy is contained within the primary reactor system.
Of 100 tons of fuel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And all the water.
Yeah.
And water at roughly 600 degrees Fahrenheit and 1,000 pounds per square inch.
Yeah.
And what they did is they designed the containment to be able to contain the energy that would be released that's contained in that liquid. but they didn't take into account the dynamic effects, the pressure vibrations that would result when that energy was being released.
Well, so I suppose you made a fuss about that and made reports and stuff. Did they fix it?
Well, what happened is it came to light because General Electric was performing tests at a test facility in San Jose on the next containment version, which was called the Mark III. And in the process of performing those tests, they had a pretty good instrumentation on the test facility, and they noticed, they became aware very rapidly of these dynamic loads, these vibratory forces.
Yeah.
And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was advised of the ongoing tests. And in 1975, finally, the NRC sent letters to all of the 16 U.S. utilities in the United States and said, how about it? You know, how about these vibratory forces that we've seen at the Mark III test facility? Were those taken into account and designed for in the Mark I plant you're operating?
And so what happened?
And the utilities came to GE and said, well, tell us that they were so that we can get the NRC off our back.
Mm-hmm.
And GE said, well, in fact, they weren't.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. So then what happened?
Well, then what happened is we got all of the utilities together, we, GE, and we organized in the spring of 1975 a rather loose organization called the Mark I Boiling Water Reactor Owners Group. And GE set out to manage the reevaluation of all of the Mark I plants.
Mm-hmm.
We hired a lot of consultants, put a lot of engineers to work, built some test facilities, and tried to identify the magnitude of the loads that had been overlooked and to figure out whether or not fixes could be put in place to make the Mark I plants meet the licensing criteria.
Right. I'm interviewing Dale Breidenbach, formerly a nuclear engineer with General Electric, and he's now talking about these Mark I GE reactors, of which Fukushima is composed, six of them, I think, and there are, 16 in still operating in the United States, right, Dale?
Well, actually, there are 23.
23. Anyway, so what happened? So they put out in this big sort of commission, investigative commission, to try and work out what to do. That was late 75. And what happened?
Well, GE and the utilities and the consultants worked, I'll say day and night, not 24/7, but pretty much close to that, and tried to figure out how bad the problem really was. And, of course, some 16 or 17 of these plants were already in operation. There were another 8 or so in the United States and another 10 around the world that hadn't been put into service yet. And it was there was a lot of pressure to try and decide what to do.
Yeah, I bet there was.
It was obvious that they no longer met the licensing criteria.
Yeah,
they were not technically safe to operate, and there was pressure to keep them running, and there of course was pressure to shut them down.
Right.
But there was more pressure to keep them running because I went to my boss one night in January of 1976 and I said, we got some real problems here. Some of these plants, the numbers that we're getting could have a complete rupture of the primary system, loss of emergency cooling water, if the numbers that we are generating right now are correct.
Yeah.
We need to tell the NRC that if we find in the very near future that these numbers are correct, we got to shut these plants down. And my boss said to me, well, it can't be that bad, Dale. And besides, if we had to shut these plants down at this point in time, it could be the end of GE's nuclear business.
Oh, my God, that makes my blood turn cold. So, what then happened?
So, the approach that was used was GE convinced the NRC that the probability of a major rupture of the primary system was very low, and therefore the plants could continue to operate. Well, the reevaluation was performed, and then eventually the fixes would be applied, and the NRC bought that.
So did they ever put any fixes over time?
Yes, they did, yes. I quit in February of 76.
Why?
Because I didn't think that was the right way to approach it. I thought, we didn't know they were safe and they shouldn't have been running.
Yeah.
The thing that happened, of course, was I quit and the program went on in 76. In 1980 or thereabouts, some 2 years later, they got the NRC's approval with the load definitions that were finally developed. What that means is they knew how strong the forces could be that they had to design to meet.
Yes.
And then some 5 or 6 years later, all of the Mark I plants eventually got fixes applied to them.
How did they fix them? Did they make the steel thicker or the concrete thicker, or did they reinforce the containment vessel?
Basically, what they did is it was different for different plants because they weren't all exactly identical. They were all identical concepts, but they had been designed by different people. They reinforced the steel structures. They put in anchor bolts and tried to tie everything down. They put in jet force deflectors inside of the containment. They put in mufflers to reduce the vibratory forces that could be experienced. There were some 15 or 20 different fixes that had to be implemented, all of which, of course, had to be implemented during a shutdown, during an outage. They couldn't do it during the plant was in operation.
Mm. And were you satisfied those fixes were adequate, Dale?
Well, I don't know, because I wasn't there anymore.
Hmm. But you must have analyzed them in your then current situation as a consultant.
Well, I thought they were pretty safe. Now, was I happy with it? No. Was I happy with the containment system itself, the Mark I containment system itself? No, because the development of the Mark I came out of the competitive pressures to make a plant that was less expensive to build. And the pressure suppression system, which is used in all of the GE boiling water reactors, was a way in which the size of the containment vessels could be kept to a minimum. In the Mark I, they are absolutely kept to a minimum. And what results is you have a very tight containment with very little room for error in case they made a mistake in the safety analysis. It also makes them difficult to maintain, to perform maintenance on. They're really tight. It's hard to get people in there, and the radiation levels are high.
They're very small.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, I'm interviewing Dale Breidenbach, formerly employed by General Electric, on these Mark I GE designed reactors. Now, Dale, when did they build the Mark I GE reactors at Fukushima?
Well, I don't know exactly what year construction was started. Unit 1 was built by Unit 1 was a General Electric project, and it went into service, commercial service, I believe, in 1971. Typically in Japan, they were taking 4 to 5 years to build a nuclear plant at that time.
Mm.
So, they started in 1965, 66, something like that. I visited the Fukushima plant in either 1970 or 71.
Mm.
I was not there for a long period of time, but in the job that I was doing as manager of product service at the time, it was my job to be to manage the organization, the engineers that would deal with the TEPCO after the plant went into service and if they had any problems.
Yeah.
My technical support to them.
And so were there problems, and how did you feel about it?
Well, in 1971, they had just gone into service. I don't recall of any particular problems that they had that were different from the problems that any complicated thing like a nuclear plant has during startup.
Mm.
And then shortly after 1971, General Electric reorganized things, and I no longer had responsibility for international plants. In about 1972 or 73, I switched over and managed the service operation for all of the domestic nuclear plants in the United States. So I didn't have direct contact with the Fukushima plant.
But they continued to build 5 more, right?
That's correct.
Now, so, okay, Dale, give us your assessment of, in fact, post-accident reactor design, how they've stood up. I know that it seems likely that Unit 1 suffered a problem and started melting down even before the tsunami and before they lost the diesel backup generators and their emergency cooling system, that, in fact, the earthquake damaged the reactor. Is that your contention, and what about the other reactors there?
Okay, I don't know if that is in fact the case or not. It certainly is the case that TEPCO, the Japanese utility, has released information just this week, earlier this week, that indicates that they had either full or very nearly full core melt on all 3 of the reactors that were in operation when the earthquake hit. The unit number 1, which is the Fukushima 1, the plant that GE built independently, appears to have had core melt within a few hours of the earthquake. I don't know, the core melt would not happen immediately, and there might have been some damage. There might have been damage to the primary system from the earthquake. Unit 1 is a little bit different than the other 4 or 5.
Mm.
Unit 1 has a thing called an emergency condenser, which is a large component at the upper levels of the reactor building, and is quite possible that that piece of equipment might have been taken out of service or been ruptured as a result of the earthquake. But I haven't seen anything that's been reported that confirms that. And, of course, the plant is so radioactive, it's very difficult for them to get in and try to figure out what really did happen.
Dale, do you think that they've only just realized that the three of them melted down within the first couple of days, or do you think that they knew right from the start and they've been sitting on that, on this information?
I don't think they knew.
Oh.
I think the instrumentation that enables them to make that judgment was wiped out by the earthquake and by the core melt and by the tsunami and the loss of electrical power and all of that.
Yeah.
And they, of course, knew that they were in serious trouble. They knew within a few days that they had fuel damage because they had hydrogen explosion. They can't generate hydrogen without fuel damage there. So they knew that things were not good, and they probably knew, or I'm sure they knew early on, that they had severe core damage. But whether they knew that it was as extensive as they now are reporting, I would say probably not.
So they're probably now putting one and one together through the retrospectoscope and working out with their new measurements and data and the robots going in and measuring pressures and temperatures and measuring radiation levels. They're putting together retrospectively what happened.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. Now, and the other thing that worries me enormously, Dale, as a physician myself and a pediatrician, is I don't think they've got any idea of how much radiation escaped initially, has been escaping all the way along because their instruments were not working. They are sort of doing transitory gamma measurements, which really doesn't... they've got no idea of the total quantity, have they? They're guessing, like 770,000 tetrabecquerels or some god-unknown figure. You know, where would they get that from?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I'm not a health physicist kind of a person, not a radiochemist, but they are certainly lacking instrumentation to be able to tell them exactly what went on.
Yeah.
I just saw today on the internet a interview with Arnie Gunderson. I know you know him, but
yes.
Anyway. He was talking with John King of CNN about hot particles and expressing a lot of concern about particles that are released that are too small to really measure with the normal radiation monitoring equipment, but that which float around and can get into the human body and cause serious damage eventually.
Yeah, there was a wonderful doctor called Dr. John Goffman who actually was employed by the Atomic Energy Commission way back and helped with Glenn Seaborg discover plutonium. And he was employed by another fellow called Arthur Tamplin to investigate the dangers of radiation related to nuclear power. And they came up with such a damning report that the AEC fired them. You know, if the Atomic Energy Commission or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission or the utilities don't like necessarily what people come up with when they're asked to produce a report, they fire them or they get them to see a psychiatrist. Which leads me on to my next question, Dale. I was privileged to be present with you three GE engineers when you made the momentous decision to resign because you didn't feel that nuclear power could ever be made safe. And I know that your wives, too, played a role in convincing you about that. Would you like to talk a little bit about what you went through, Dale, as professional men, how you were shunned in the community of Santa Cruz where GE is located, how tough it was on your families and how it took you a long time to work out how to be able to survive financially now that you're not working at GE. Would you like to just give us a sort of paint us a scenario of what you went through?
Well, as I indicated a little bit earlier, Helen, it was certainly a gut-wrenching experience for me. And I was, of course, concerned about, you know, how would I make a living? How would I provide for my family? What would I do? How would the many friends that I had within the industry feel about me resigning and publicly saying, telling about what I knew? And it would not at all have been possible without the support of my wife, who was very understanding and supportive. And so, you know, it's just a difficult decision, but it was one that I felt I had to make.
It was a very noble decision. Would you like to put Shah on now, Dale? Dale's wife is Shah Breidenbach, a close friend of mine also.
Hello.
Shah.
Yes.
Yeah, welcome to the program, Shah. I've just said to the audience that it would be really interesting from a personal perspective if you would describe what Dale went through, what you went through, what the family went through after his really noble decision to resign from General Electric on principles of safety and public health, and how you were shunned in the community, what happened to you as you still continued to live in Santa Cruz, and how difficult it was to, you know, move on to something else so that Dale could support the family. Would you like to just give a brief sort of picture and scenario of what you went through, Shah?
Sure. We were living in San Jose at the time, Helen. Not Santa Cruz.
That's right, sorry.
We live in Santa Cruz
yeah.
now. Well, it was heartbreaking to watch Dale agonize over that decision. He had so many friends, and he was so well-respected in his career, and initially he had been very proud of being part of something that they thought was really going to be a good thing for mankind. And then to begin to learn a lot of aspects of it that came to light as time went on, you know, such as what to do with the waste. And the ramifications, the connection to possible weapons, and of course, at that time, we didn't even conceive of the type of terrorism that we see going on in the world today. But so there were these kinds of considerations that went beyond the engineers' technology concerns that I think it became impossible to continue to stay a part of that without these things being addressed. But it was heartbreaking for me to see him struggle with that, and then of course, I would be supportive, and I, from what I learned as a non-engineer, there were too many social considerations. I thought, I don't think this is a good thing. And
yes.
As far as the family, of course, that San Jose at that time was the headquarters of General Electric's Atomic Energy Division, and so there were a whole lot, and we lived close to work. And so when he did quit, people were shocked, and some people applauded us for his courage and said they would be supportive, but many in the industry just would never speak to him again.
Yes.
Which would continue to this day. People who had been close friends.
Yes.
And, yeah. Does that answer your question?
Well,
as far as the kids can, we had three, well, let's see. from 11 to 16 were the ages of our children. And teenagers, you know, don't want to be singled out for anything.
No.
So it was hard on them, I would say. While they understood and they were very proud of their dad, at the same time, schoolyard jeers and comments, you know, they would just as soon not have had to endure.
I'm interviewing Sha Breidenbach, who is Dale Breidenbach's wonderful wife. Now, Sha, it's now a long time, 1975 to 2011. It's 36 years since he resigned. Amazing. Through the retrospectoscope then, Sha Breidenbach, how do you feel about what Dale did and the course he then took in life? How do you feel about that?
Oh, I feel very proud, and I feel very proud of any tiny piece I might have had in playing a part in this. And I cannot conceive of life had he not done that.
Yeah.
Once you know that you are a part of something that has the potential for being very destructive, not just to a small area, but worldwide, as we now see manifested in Japan, it becomes impossible. It would be impossible for me to conceive of any other path. And of course, we had many financial concerns and even safety concerns, but those did not bear fruit.
No.
And we've been, I would say, life has been personally blessed by that decision and the experiences that Dale especially has had, but I've shared some of those with him, and people we've met who I think are just people who are, I want to say, right-minded. And, you know, there's a Buddhist concept of right livelihood and all of that. And that's how I feel. I can't conceive of what the path would have been otherwise.
Yes, it's so sad though, Sha, isn't it, that there are so many men and some women in positions as such as the one Dale was in so many years ago in General Electric, who know deep in their hearts and souls that what they're doing is really not right, and I'm putting that mildly, but who do not have the courage and foresight, I think, to step outside the boundaries of accepted societal behaviour and who they are and the money they're earning to do the right thing. And there are a few noble souls who lead the way. And, of course, Dale was one of them. So for that, I salute both of you, actually, knowing both of you.
Nice to hear your voice after so many years.
Yeah. Could you put Dale back now, please?
Absolutely. And thank you very much.
Hello.
Hello, Dale.
I'm back.
That was great. Now, I've got some more questions for you. I read this morning about the PLC program. It's a program logic control, a PLC, and it is put in many nuclear reactors now. In other words, they're computerizing many of the reactors, and when you designed reactors, there were no computers involved, right, Dale?
Well, there were. Yes, there were computers.
Oh, there were.
There were computers. Oh, yeah, yeah, but not like they are used today. Yeah.
Well, what people are talking about now is this Stuxnet virus, which people think was designed by the Israelis to screw up the Iranian enrichment facilities, their centrifuges.
In Iran.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, okay.
And The article that I read today went on to say that, in fact, like the Stuxnet virus that was so successful, it's spelled S-T-U-X-N-E-T, so that there are other very smart, intelligent, often young men who can design such viruses to get into to components such as nuclear power plants. Would you like to comment about that, Dale? Is that possible?
Well, I can comment on it. I'm sure that that's possible, and I know actually know more about it than you do, because I only know what I read in the papers too.
Yeah,
I'm not a computer engineer, but of course, the concept that you're talking about is something that I'm sure, or I know the U.S. Defense Department is very much concerned about. You know, we're talking about cyber wars, and that's something that I'm sure there are some terrorists who would be trying to figure out how to do that, to cause some severe disruption, damage, whatever. And
well, it may not be terrorists. I mean, it can be young geeks who love experimenting and playing around with this stuff. It doesn't necessarily have to be terrorists, Dale.
Well, no, that's true. Although, yeah. What I've recently read about it is that I think it is more extensive, or that there are. I don't think it's just the ordinary hackers that are doing it. I think it is done with an intent to cause harm.
So. Well, yeah, but you can't necessarily prove that. And I think
no. In
this day and age of computers and incredible high-tech IT, anything's possible. Now, there's another point I wanted to move on. I read today that there are 105,000 tons of highly contaminated water in Unit 1. At Fukushima.
Okay, I don't know the number, but I know they've got a lot of it. Yes.
And Arne Gundersen, the other nuclear engineer who I've interviewed for this program and who you know,
yes.
He says that the structure of the whole nuclear reactor buildings and containment vessel has been severely weakened by all this water that have been pouring in, tons and thousands of tons of water. Would you like to comment on that, Dale Breidenbach?
Well, I think that's certainly a good possibility. The reactor that water is of course in a lot of different places in the Daiichi plant, and I'm sure there is a whole lot of it in the bottom of the reactor building. We know that there's a lot of it in the basement of the turbine building, which is a different structure. And the fact that water is there is, of course, one of the reasons that the plant got in such severe trouble in the first place, because all of the electrical switchgear that controls the emergency cooling and the normal cooling is pretty much located in the basement of the turbine building. And so that seawater, which was brought in there by the tsunami, wiped out the normal electrical systems. But, of course, the plant operator, TEPCO, in order to try and prevent fuel melt, core melt of the reactor, they've been pumping tons and tons and tons of seawater into the reactor, or into the reactor building, and some into the reactor core, some in spent fuel pools, and that water is radioactively contaminated. And I'm sure there is a lot of it building up in the basement of the reactor building, the turbine building, and of course a lot of it has already leaked out to sea.
Yeah, it's so serious. Okay, Dale, let's move on to some sort of higher philosophical plane. Just from your experience in the nuclear industry, working both within the industry and without, for so long. What is your prognosis now for the whole nuclear power industry post-Fukushima?
Well, I'm sure that what's happening, of course, is there is a lot of pressure in the United States for the NRC to take a careful look at all of the Mark I plants and to see if there what lessons should be learned from the Fukushima accident and what that means for the U.S. plants. There are, of course, another 10 or 15 Mark I plants in other parts of the world. There's six or eight, I don't know the exact numbers, somewhere between 6 and 10 in Japan. There are 4 or 5 in Germany. There's a couple in Switzerland. There's 1 or 2 in Spain. All of those plants are going to be looked at closely, I hope, and see if what happened at Fukushima is possible to happen at the other plants, and hopefully it will take them less than 6 to 10 years to figure out what to do. The thing that's kind of interesting in the United States is that most of the Mark I plants are up for license extension review because most of them are now reaching the end of their normal license life. And I was listening briefly this morning to a proceeding going on in Washington, D.C. before the NRC, at which they were talking about license extensions and what should be done. And the Vermont Yankee plant was given an extension of its operating license approximately a week after the Fukushima accident occurred.
By the NRC.
By the NRC,
yeah.
Right.
Without any
consideration of what the Fukushima accident might mean to the ongoing operation of Vermont Yankee. And, in fact, I think they approved an increase in the license in the operating limit, too, the power output. So I don't know what's going to happen. I can see the handwriting on the wall, what the industry position is going to be, is that what happened at Fukushima is a result of a earthquake that was far beyond what the plant was supposed to be designed to withstand, a tsunami that was much higher than what the plant was supposed to be designed to withstand, and therefore that can't happen at any of the Mark I plants in the United States or Europe or Spain or any place else. What Japan is going to do is maybe a little bit more questionable because all of the Mark I plants in Japan are, of course, in a very active seismic area. They're all basically ocean-cooled, and so they've got they can't hide behind that particular excuse. But I don't know what's going to happen. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of pressure to keep those plants in operation because they need the electrical power. We're terrified of what global warming might result. I don't know if you've been reading the weather reports in the United States.
I have, yep.
Hotter than hell all over the United States, and so there's going to be a lot of pressure to keep the nuclear plants running.
Well, I personally think that no one bloody well should be using air conditioners in the United States. Maybe Houston, where it's so awful and hot and humid. But, you know, people have forgotten what sweat glands are for. And sweat glands are so that when you sweat and the sweat evaporates, it takes heat with it. And it's called the latent period of vaporization. It cools you down. You know, before we had electricity, there were no air conditioners. And I can't help, when I go to America, I absolutely boil in the summer. I mean, everyone wears T-shirts inside when it's snowing and freezing outside, instead of putting on layered clothing and jumpers and sweaters. And in the summer, you go into a theater or any public building. It's so cold, it's like being in a refrigerator. I think the whole thing's nuts.
Well, I agree with you.
And I also...
I grew up in South Dakota where it was very hot in the summer and very cold in the winter. And we had stoves, but we didn't have any air conditioning.
There you go. See, and we've become spoilt soft like jellos, wanting to maintain ourselves at the same temperature the whole year. I mean, that's not our entitlement now when you look at what's happening to the weather. And the other thing I would like to say, Dale Bridenbaugh, is that I predict through my crystal ball that Fukushima will signal the end over time of the nuclear power industry. And what I'm hoping is that it will have ongoing ramifications to impinge upon the wicked nuclear weapons industry, which is giving, you know, Obama's going to give it a shot of $85 billion extra dollars in the arm to build three new huge facilities to make new nuclear weapons. So the whole thing, from my perspective, is totally insane and becomes more psychotic by the minute.
Well, I agree with you, Ellen. I fully agree. Let me put in one little pitch, which I assume you are aware of, but... you know, the U.S. Department of Energy has undertaken a program to try and get the U.S. power reactor industry to use some of the recycled plutonium from out of date nuclear weapons to burn up some of the plutonium in power plants, and I think that is the most ridiculous thing that I have heard.
Well, they had some of it in Unit 3 at Fukushima.
Yes, they did. Not from weapons, but
no.
they had plutonium there. Yeah. Ox fuel. Yeah.
Yeah. Things are so. I don't know. I've always said it's going to take a major meltdown, Dale.
We've had three of them.
We've had three of them now. Let alone the cooling pools. Four cooling pools going as well. So, and I think, well, from my reading, Dale, there's been such a cover-up in Japan, both from the government, from TEPCO, and then the International Atomic Energy Agency had the gall to step in the other day and say that TEPCO's behaved in a, what was the word? I can't think of the adjective, but in an extraordinarily responsible fashion. So even they are lying. I mean, it's really, Dale, the lies that get to me from the nuclear industry more than anything. You know, if we lied in medicine, we'd be deregistered. We'd be killing our patients. No way you would have lied in your work, yet the industry per se lies.
Well, I can't disagree with you.
I know you wouldn't rave on like this the way I'm raving on, but at least you know me well enough to know that I do rave on, and also that, you know, unfortunately, I'm often right, which is also a pain in the neck. Anyway, we're all getting older. You know, I'm now 73 nearly, and I got involved in this actually when I was flown out by you people to California when you were making your decision to leave GE to work on Proposition 15, which was to essentially close down the reactors in California.
And of course, Prop 15 sort of succeeded in California. I mean, it was defeated at the election, but the legislature passed laws just before the election that basically enacted almost everything that Prop 15 required.
That was great.
There hasn't been a new nuclear plant in California since then.
No, and I think they're well on the way to closing now Diablo Canyon and San Onofre, which are both built on or very close to earthquake faults themselves.
Right, yeah. And I think that that's a very likely result of the Fukushima accident. Let's hope so.
Well, we've run out of time, Dale and Shah. It's been an absolute pleasure to interview you on this program, and I hope everyone listening takes a leaf out of Dale's book and does the right thing for the human race and for their own moral conscience. If that happened, you know, we'd probably be able to save the planet. Anyway, Dale, thank you very, very much.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me on, Helen.
Okay, that's...
I look forward to seeing you again one of these days.
Yeah, I'm going to come and stay with you. You have a hot tub, right?
I do.
Oh, yeah, well, I imagine
Unfortunately,
myself...
Unfortunately, it's cooled by Diablo, or heated by Diablo.
Oh, Dale, you don't say. Why not solar? Well, anyway, I'm going to sit in your hot tub and drink red wine with you.
Okay, all right, okay. That's the deal.
Okay, thanks, love.
Bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dale Breidenbach, a former nuclear engineer and retired energy consultant in the area of nuclear plant safety and licensing. Thanks for listening again. You know, I think as you listen to this program more and more, you'll become better and better educated about nuclear engineering and nuclear physics and health physics and all sorts of things about which it is imperative for you to understand in this nuclear day and age. Okay, we'll see you next time. No, we'll talk with you next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.